Listeners, we have a problem. Some of you are still settling for stale, mediocre coffee. Luckily, we have some of the world's greatest minds on the case working hard to change that for you with Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend if you like to shake it up. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this splendid coffee to your home in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a Coffee of the Month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. All the convenience, none of the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. When it comes to coffee, staleness is not an option. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, Movie Monkeys. Thanks for caressing that play button on our 351st episode. For you and I, specifically. There's more than that on the whole channel because of the ones with Chris. And the first one where we will simply call this podcast the Ellis's Analysis. Ellis's Analysis.
Killing it.
The tongue twister that is a lot of S's in there. Nothing will change about the podcast, except there will be no more counting up with the next 100 project, next 200 project, etc. It was my idea to do that in the first place. I should have realized that would eventually be wrong, like the top 100 project was too. But anyway, enough of the counting. But this would be the next 200 project. Wouldn't that have been fun? Not really. Okay, today's talk is about Apollo 13, and cover your ears if you don't like spoilers. I'm the guy who hurls when he goes into space, but I can also eat the acid of a dead rhinoceros, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who sure loves a good movie, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
They're both Bill Paxton references. Did you catch that at the end when he says, not quite the end, but when the Lem is being floated off on its own, you can hear Paxton say, she sure was a good ship. And he based that on the actual Fred Hayes. You can hear him on the recordings they got from NASA where he says, she sure was a good ship.
That's like a little bit of Stockholm Syndrome, because one might say she was the opposite of a good ship. It could have been worse, but she kind of screwed them over.
Well, no, that's the Lem we're talking about here, and the Lem is what saved them. The Lem had nothing to do with the explosion. And
Lem was innocent in all this.
They were attached together.
Okay, good point. I forgot the whole Russian nesting doll situation where they were switching this and that through a lot of the film. It's quite interesting, actually, from the technical point of view.
And you think about how the rocket starts, this big-ass thing that's many stories tall, and in the end, they're in this little pod thing that's about the size of our table here.
They just keep ditching parts of their ships and letting it drift off to space, and it's so interesting to think how many things it takes to get them out there and how little they actually need when it comes down to it.
The skin of the Lem is so thin in some places, you can almost punch through with your hand. It's kind of a scary thought. Even if this mission went perfectly fine, that's a bit of a scary thought. Although they wouldn't be in the Lem ever if the mission went fine. They just went on there for the television broadcast just to show people. But until Lovell and Hayes were supposed to go to the moon, they would have stayed in the command module the whole time. Okay, the coming attractions opinion question. The moment where everyone holds their breath to see if the Odyssey crew survived re-entry always has me in knots. And we know they survived. It's a real story. And also, I've seen the movie many, many times. What other movies where you know the result, either because you've seen the movie lots of times or because it's a true story, always has you on the edge of your seat about what's going to happen? What is going to happen?
This was easy for me. It's one of my favorite movies, Kill Bill, which I've seen at least a dozen times. And every single time, I cannot breathe when the bride is buried alive in that coffin.
Oh, good choice.
The sound design, the dirt hitting the roof of that coffin, and Uma Thurman's performance. It shortens my life a little bit every time I see it.
We talked when we did that podcast about when I saw that movie by myself in a small theater that didn't have a lot of that extra light you have with the exit sign. It probably had that, but didn't have a lot of the extra light you have in the bigger theaters, bigger rooms. And I don't usually, but I felt claustrophobic when that happened.
I saw it in the theater. I recall it was pitch black in that scene. You hear her breathing. Mm. It's so well done. It's such a great scene.
I have a few answers to this question. There's no real right or wrong answer, but Cruise climbing the Burj Khalifa in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which I've talked about in other podcasts, how exciting that is. Especially when I saw it in the theater. But even at home, it's, he's going to fall! You know, he's not going to, but the climax in the basement in Psycho, which isn't as effective now that I've seen Norman Bates come down that staircase in his mother's wig, or in a wig, so many times, but it used to be really effective on me. The dumpster monster in Mulholland Drive.
Oh yeah, nothing will ever be scarier than the first time I saw that. That took a year off my life.
Both the ending of Back to the Future 1 and 3. 3 is close to being as good as Back to the Future 1 with the climax on the train. But the climax in Apollo 13 is the perfect example of what I'm getting at here, which is, oh my God, what's going to happen? How are they going to make it all in? And actually in this movie, when Hank says, it's good to see you again, then the control room erupts. When you watch the actual video, which I'll mention a few times in this podcast, as soon as they saw the parachutes open, they know that they survived because they had to do that manually. Either they'd find the ship floating down to Earth safely, or the guys would have plummeted in the ocean and died. Or it would have burned up entirely and they would never would have found the ship, period. So that's what it was in reality. But when Hanks actually says, it's good to see you again, that moment always gets me. It's really awesome. Okay, Apollo 13 will have its 25th birthday next week because it was released by Universal on June 30th, 1995. It was a huge hit here where it made triple its budget, but it made double that worldwide. Big time money. We'll talk about money again in a few minutes, but before we do that, let's talk about the Apollo 13 skinny. Please give it to us.
Tom Hanks is Jim Lovell, the astronaut who commanded the ill-fated Apollo 13 mission to the moon, where a catastrophic explosion forced the crew to abort their mission. Instead, they had to work against the odds with the help of NASA Mission Control to engineer what was left of their vessel to get back home to Earth safely, all while the world watched.
And if you're hearing any kind of what might be sound like fart noises, we just ate, but for some reason my stomach is making noises. I'm not farting. I swear to God.
I plead the fifth.
Or, in a nutshell, so when the ship re-enters the atmosphere at the end with the three guys, it's 6,000 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Well done.
I didn't know you were going to like it that much. That's good. I haven't had a very good one in a while, I don't think, but that was pretty good, I thought, yeah. Rotten Tomatoes critics, 96% of them like this film, 87 fresh, 4 rotten, for an average of 8.2 out of 10, and 87% of audiences. It was second at the 1995 U.S. box office. Batman Forever was number one. Toy Story was number three. We reviewed that a long time ago for the Top 100 Project. Seven, should have been seventh, but it was 12th. And Clueless, which we covered last year, was 25th. Those last three we covered. So if you want to hear us talk about Toy Story 7 or Clueless in the archives, go look for those. Apollo 13's 195th all-time adjusted for inflation, with $373 million adjusted. Hanks has many on that list. And of course, you can probably guess what number one is. The most successful movie Tom Hanks has ever made. Money, Forrest, money.
Money and Forrest Gump go together like peas and carrots.
And you know who he plays in that movie, at least briefly?
Forrest Gump.
No, but he also plays Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Guy
he does,
who started
too.
The KKK.
Guy who's been in the news again lately.
Mm-hmm. That's why I bring it up now. All right, back to Apollo 13. Two Oscars for the film. Editing and sound, it won those two. Good choices, I think. It was also nominated for Best Picture. Supporting actor Ed Harris. Supporting actress Kathleen Quinlan. The adapted screenplay. The visual effects. The sets. Such detail in these sets. Maybe should have won that. And the music score, which I know you don't like, but we'll get back to that later on. But no nomination for Ron Howard as director, which I think is a travesty. And nothing for Tom Hanks, which isn't such a travesty. It was a pretty good category. He'd already won the last 2 years. He didn't have to get nominated every year. But he could have been. And for the AFI stuff, Apollo 13th was 50th on the top 100 quotes with, you can probably guess,
Houston, we have a problem.
Which in reality, Jim Lovell said, Houston, we've had a problem in the past tense.
One of the reviews I read talked about this, and that was such an important intentional choice because it puts you in the present. Speaking about it in the past actually does just give the audience a different impression, making it present tense. Adds more immediacy.
And again, in that Lost Moon feature that's on the DVD, Blu-ray, all that stuff. I think it's also on YouTube. When you hear Jim Lovell say that over the microphone, it doesn't sound all that urgent. But of course, astronauts are not supposed to get worked up about anything. So even something like that, and Hanks isn't freaking out, but it's more like, Houston, we have a problem, rather than, yeah, we've had a problem. Something that wasn't nominated for the quotes list, I think should have been, at least nominated. Failure is not an option.
You want to talk about which line is more a part of our zeitgeist now, and failure is not an option. It feels like it's always existed as a phrase. I was actually surprised to learn that it came from Apollo 13. I thought it was just one of those things that always was out there in the ether.
Houston, we have a problem is something that people even say now, though, and they certainly did for the few years after that. It's like in Jerry Maguire, who wasn't saying, you had me at...
hello.
Whatever. Well, not just hello, but in that movie Shallow Hal, you had me at get lost. So other movies even quoted Jerry Maguire, and other movies probably quoted, we have a problem. Apollo 13 was 12th on the top 100 cheers. It's Wonderful Life was number one. And it was nominated for a ton of lists it did not make. Both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. I'm not saying it should have made those, but I would not have argued if it did. the top 100 thrills. Obviously, I agree with that. If I'm telling you I'm still on the edge of my seat after all the times I've seen this movie. The top 25 music scores and the top 50 heroes, which again, you can't really find this stuff anymore on AFI's website. I assume they mean level, but maybe they mean all the NASA people, including the guys on the ground. Anyway, top 50 heroes. So, what'd you think of Apollo 13?
I hadn't seen it since it came out, but it really stands up. I like that it seems to bridge that line between a Hollywood film that's just there to entertain us and crowd please, and a very realistic, almost journalistic or documentary style portrayal of real events. He really nails the verisimilitude, but maybe just best of all is, as you say, the buildup of suspense, the pacing. It's so exceptional, and the performances are out of this world.
Yeah, Ron Howard not getting nominated for Best Director is just absurd. He maybe should have won rather than just get nominated, which he wasn't even that. But that was Mel Gibson's year for Braveheart. I love Braveheart, but this is a better movie, and it's a better directed movie. And that was a well-directed movie. People can hate on Mel Gibson all they want to, but he did a great job for only his second film. Howard had done 8 or 10 at that point, maybe even more.
I will hate on Mel Gibson, and I'll hate on Braveheart, because I don't like that movie. But I 1,000% agree that Apollo 13 is a better directed film.
Ron Howard's best film, I think. I love Parenthood.
It's like him at his very best.
I've liked a lot of his movies. We have quite a few of them behind me over there on the shelf, DVD and Blu-ray, mostly DVD. But I think this one is his very best. And you talked a minute ago about the verisimilitude. So we're definitely going to intermingle the reality of the mission with this fictional movie, which is mostly true. There's a commentary track on the DVD. I think it's on the Blu-ray as well. The Lovells do it, Jim and Marilyn. He's talking about how, for example, when they get mad at each other and yelling at one point, Paxson's accusing Bacon, or Hayes, I guess, is accusing Swaggart of pushing the wrong thing. Lovell says that would never happen. They'd never freak out. I think that's probably true. You need to have people that go to space who are extremely cool customers. But when something like this happens, which had never happened before, people had died on Earth in spacecrafts. That's why when Gene Kran says, we've never lost an American in space before. Well, that was true. They hadn't lost an American in space. But men had died before they ever even got into space, including the mission that killed Gus Grissom and two other guys. I forget the other two guys now, but Gus Grissom is one of them.
And as we learned from First Man, a movie that owes a lot to Apollo 13, these pilots died with some frequency, because they were all test pilots, right?
Yeah.
It was a really dangerous job.
Great companion piece to this movie, and maybe more popular movie for a lot of people, would be The Right Stuff.
Oh,
although
yeah.
This was a big hit, and that was not. And they're companion pieces in a lot of ways. I prefer Apollo 13. I've watched it so many times. The Right Stuff I've seen probably 3 times, but not in a long time. So the actual mission took off on April 11th, 1970. The explosion happened 2 days later, and they spent 7 days in space. Most of that, well, definitely 4 days of those final five, in a nice cold cabin.
What a miserable experience it was for them. Take away even just the terror of it.
They couldn't sleep, the discomfort, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, being cold constantly. Because they had to shut so much power down to keep them alive at all. I saw the movie in 1995 with my then girlfriend. And I remember being excited for it because I was a big Hanks guy after Forrest Gump especially. I don't think I'd seen Toy Story. I think I saw that until it was on videotape years later. Then I saw the re-release of Apollo 13 in IMAX in 2002, which was very impressive to watch on that huge screen. But they cut out nearly 40 minutes of plot. I think during that screening, I'm thinking, but where's that scene and that one? Because I knew the movie that well. There is a scene in this movie that I think they probably should have cut out, but it was probably just to give Kathleen Quinlan more screen time, where she loses the ring in the shower. It really happened, apparently. And she did find it again, the real Marilyn Lovell, but who really cares?
It was an omen. Bad luck,
I guess.
Sign.
Plus it's 13. It comes after 12, Marilyn. Now, one of the big things they use in this movie, which I don't know if they ever used again, I thought they did in other films. I could swear I heard other people talking about this thing, but it said online that it was just Apollo 13 that did 600 arcs, or maybe even more than 600, on the KC-135, which they call the vomit comet, because people tended to vomit. And that would give you about 20 or 30 seconds of weightlessness.
23 seconds, they say.
Okay, there you go. So you've got to be ready to shoot. And that's why they had so many arcs. And there's not that much weightlessness in this movie, but there are some shots that if they faked it, then that's an impressive green screen, which they didn't fake it because they really were floating around. But they were, of course, on Earth. That's the difference. Most movies before this, and even sometimes in this movie, and then some since, lots since, have just used seesaws or this kind of thing where you're sitting on a box that's unsteady and then you just make yourself look like you're bobbing around a little bit. Even Apollo 13 did that plenty of times, but they did have a lot of shots, particularly when they had something floating in the air or when the guys were full body moving through the thing. And they got weightlessness that way.
It pays off. It looks absolutely incredible. Do you know how they do it? You know how they pull off weightlessness in that plane?
Tell us.
So they go up as high as a plane can go, and then they free fall for 23 seconds. They just nose first, free fall. And then everybody's falling at the same speed, and it mimics weightlessness. Actually, they're not weightless. They're all falling, but the plane is falling at the same speed.
Right.
Which is terrifying to think of doing one time, mm-hmm. let alone hundreds of times. And you can totally see how people must throw up all the time.
They usually do, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder when you see that scene of Paxton throwing up, maybe he really threw up.
That scene, no, apparently that's just soup or something in his mouth that he lets out the right time.
It's disgusting. It reminds me of that scene from The Simpsons. No, it'll get on the instruments. But they all just seem to take it in stride and laugh it off, which is gross.
Well, the line that he has right afterwards, I'm hungry, I could eat the ass of a dead rhinoceros. Gary Busey says the exact same thing in Point Break, and on the commentary that Ron Howard does, he does one by himself, and then the Lovells have a separate track. Howard talks about how Gary Busey was visiting that day and said they should say that line, and it's the exact same thing he says in Point Break when they're going to eat the subs. Utah, give me two.
A phrase that really we could have been spared from ever hearing once.
Yeah, this movie has no bad language, and I don't think it even says the F word once, but ass in that context. Maybe that's as controversial as it gets. So in the movie, and in reality, Jim gets the mission as the commander because Alan Shepard has a bad ear. So that's good luck for him, and serendipitous, he shouldn't have been on Apollo 13. But then the irony is that Jack gets the mission instead of Ken Mattingly, because Ken Mattingly has a sickness issue. Although he's not sick, he never does get the measles at all, but that's why he's kept up, because somebody they were exposed to had the measles, and they worried he might get sick in space. The doctor is insulted a lot in this movie. Christian Clemenson, who's Bobby, 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 Bobby in broadcast news. That's who he played long before. And that scene where he's pissed off because they're all pulling off their medical instruments. Now I've lost all of them, flight. Just a little medical mutiny, doc. But the doctor's not wrong. This is too important for you to risk just because Madeline wants to go to space so bad. And yes, it's important to keep your team together. But they're supposed to all train together. So if something like that happens, maybe he actually had the measles rather than might get them later on. You got to make sure that Swaggart or the other two guys are ready to take over for their counterparts on the mission.
Here in 2020, to hear a hero be like, I don't have the measles, man, is not as sympathetic. Because, yeah, he was right. But we're living in a world where a lot of people have made a lot of other people sick because they were convinced they were fine when they actually weren't.
That's one of the examples of why this movie won the editing Oscar. It should have won for all kinds of reasons. Obviously, the liftoff sequence is one of them. What an incredible sequence that is. But when Jack finds out he gets the mission, he's in the shower with a lady. He's a ladies' man. The guy in reality apparently was. So Bacon comes out, answers the phone, listens for a minute, then, yeah! Hard cut to the disappointed look on Gary Sinise's face. Great edit. One of my favorite edits in the whole movie.
Hard agree.
Hanks doesn't get to spend a lot of time with his family in this film, for obvious reasons. But he does have a few scenes with his younger son, at least. Miko Hughes plays Jeffrey. And it seems like the one between Jim and Jeffrey, where he's explaining how he's going to land the ship, that Ron Howard and Tom Hanks, either together or in other movies, do so well and give this movie that heart. And of course, Marilyn's watching, so she gets to witness how sweet her husband can be. Maybe Jim wasn't actually like that, but I really like that scene. It doesn't need to be there. I'm sure that was cut out of the IMAX release.
I disagree. I think it needs to be there because you create peril by giving the audience a situation where you know there's something to lose. If somebody has nothing that makes them valuable, then why do you care if they die in space? Well, we know that this is an affectionate, loving family man, a truly good guy who's really loved by his people. Then you know how much of a tragedy it will be if they fail. If it was just Kevin Bacon's character, you wouldn't care as much. They don't illustrate any close relationships with him and anybody. Even Paxton, we know he has a pregnant wife, and that's meaningful, but we don't really see them together, so everything's really wrapped up in the character of Lovell, the real person of Lovell, but Hanks.
I love when Tracy Reiner, who plays Mary Hayes, cries when the ship lifts off. Marilyn smiles, and Marilyn and Mary, how about that? And Mary starts crying. Now, she doesn't know something bad's going to happen, but she's terrified for her husband, and then it ends up being right. We don't see her family too much, but they don't forget about them either. We see them here and there. It's obviously mostly the Lovells once things go wrong. Quinlan doesn't get a lot of time with Hanks either. She was nominated for the Supporting Actress Oscar. I think a worthy choice. I don't think she should have won or anything. But she has to act with almost everybody else in the movie other than anybody from NASA. Because her and Hanks have a couple scenes early on. And that's another thing that's not true. Lovell and the rest of them would have been in Mission Control when Neil Armstrong's moon landing was happening. They wouldn't have been in their house because they were an important part of NASA too. We see that later on. All these other people that do ECOM and the Mission Controllers and the one guy, Brett Cullen, it was Joker's dad last year. We've talked a lot lately about good animation voices. Brett Cullen would be a great deep voice for animation. But anyway, that guy talks about how he's going to take his Johnny Cash records when he goes to the moon on whatever it was going to be, whatever mission it was going to be. So not everybody's interchangeable, but a lot of those people that you see in Mission Control would have been actual astronauts who might have gone, and some of them probably did go on future missions. We see Pete Conrad, I believe, in there, and of course, Ken Mattingly ends up being an important part of this, and he could have been on the mission and would have been had it not been for the measles thing.
You think they would just want to be in the control room anyway if they could for a moment like that? That's exactly where you'd want to be.
For the moonwalk, yeah. Mm. Even for a liftoff of any of the flights, you would think, because they all know how dangerous that is, let alone beyond that. But one thing that's portrayed so well is the boredom in the control room. Okay, boredom maybe is a little bit strong. They're cleaning out pipes. They're talking about what they're going to do in future missions because they've done this enough times. There have been multiple moon missions already and lots of trips into space. Lovell himself had gone up into space before and circled the moon. He didn't actually land on it. That it's almost routine. And Xander Berkeley, who plays the PR guy, says to Marilyn that civilians, the populace, just think it's about as exciting as going to Pittsburgh. We like Pittsburgh, but not the most exciting city in the world. But then again, the movie's portraying that the people in Mission Control, in some ways, agree with that. Meh, this is just ho-hum job stuff. Until the explosion happens. Then they're locked in, and they're dead serious.
And I think that is part of the verisimilitude. It's such a massive strength of the movie that you show people being bored is the wrong word, but it's banal what they're doing. It just doesn't feel exciting. You don't get a swell of music when they're doing the thing that they've done 12 times before, not even counting all the other launches that they've done. And on top of that, the set, there's tons of notes on Wikipedia about all the meticulous detail that they went to recreate it as closely as possible. So much so that there were consultants on set who actually worked in NASA Mission Control. They would forget that they were on a set. And the one guy talks about how he went to leave the set at the end of the day and he went to take the elevator and was like, oh, wait, this is a prop. I'm not in NASA right now. But the detail that I love the best about it is that it's beaten up. It's a little bit dirty. It's just not shiny and new the way that it was once upon a time when all the moon missions started. And their costumes, so many films do period pieces. And I'm not a costume designer, and I could never pinpoint the exact decisions that they make in one film to the next that make something look very much like you're there versus, and I was thinking about this a lot, a movie that I love, Hidden Figures, is a movie that indulged in the prettiest costumes. Okay. Did those women dress like that? Almost definitely not. Even if they had one dress that looked that beautiful, it wouldn't look that brand new. Every outfit that they wore looked like they had just bought it that weekend. And not a hair out of place. The perfection. And that's the look that they were going for. It was a very polished film. Whereas Apollo 13 wants to trick you into thinking that you're actually watching a documentary. There's so much authenticity. And it really, really puts you there. To me, it is what puts this movie over the edge. All the little choices that he made. And there's a lot. And it was hard work to get it to look right. The rocket launch. They shot everything brand new. They didn't use any existing footage.
And some of it would be CGI, but not all of it. Apparently Buzz Aldrin, the real guy, wanted to use that footage for NASA. He asked Ron Howard if they could have that for NASA, and I don't know what the answer. Maybe it was yes. It probably would have been.
What would NASA do with it?
I don't know exactly either, but it says that online. I guess the point being, this is the compliment I can pay your fictional movie based on this real story. We want to use your fictional footage in what is real for us. And we'll forget about people saying the moon landing was faked. Not the point of this podcast. Well, Hanks himself was such a NASA nerd, and Ron Howard says this too on the commentary, that just getting to wear the suit was his goal. So the scene where he walks down the gantryway with the other two guys behind him, Howard says something like, this is what Tom wanted. The movie's all about this for him. And Hanks is a huge fan of 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is one reason why in Castaway, when he finds the bathroom door that he uses as the sail, he sits the way he does in homage to the monkey scenes in 2001 when they see the monolith. And that's also why it was supposed to be the also Sprach Zarathustra song that Fred plays rather than Spirit in the Sky, because he even says he wanted it to be the theme for 2001. I guess that's based on reality, but then Hanks himself would have been more than fine with that because he's a huge fan of 2001. We've covered Hanks a lot in this podcast. We did Forrest Gump, Toy Story, and Saving Private Ryan for the Top 100 Project. We did Splash last year. Big, I don't remember when we did Big, but it's somewhere in our archives. It might not have been 2018 to make it 30 years old.
But that feels about right.
And A League of Their Own we did a couple years ago as well. So here's another one of Hanks' movies, and we see some of the themes we've seen in a lot of those movies, a lot of his recurring things. Like Chris and I are going to talk about a Moneyball later this week. Cruise always runs, Pitt always eats, Hanks always pees. Well, of course, he pees in this movie. He has other recurring themes in his films, though, too. He always wants to go home.
Yeah, once you said that to me after, or maybe it was during Apollo 13.
Forrest Gump. It's
always
Captain
true.
Phillips, Castaway, Apollo 13.
Toy Story.
All four Toy Story movies he wants to try to get back home to Andy, or Bonnie, I guess, in the fourth one. Also, a thing that maybe people don't talk about so much are the bittersweet endings in Tom Hanks' movies, even when things work out, like in this movie. It was a successful failure, as Lovell apparently said in his book, and that's a line that Hanks reads in voiceover. So you can't call it a true happy ending. It's more of a bittersweet ending. Obviously, Forrest Gump is. Jenny's dead. He gets the kid, but Jenny's dead. Castaway, he finally gets back home and survives, but he loses Kelly. Captain Phillips, he survives, but that's not a very happy ending. And I could keep going on and on. And then Toy Story 4, he doesn't get to keep Buzz and the other toys as longtime friends, but he gets to be with Bo. And obviously, Toy Story 3 is giving up Andy. So his characters, and maybe this is what Hanks wants in his screenplays. He could probably command wherever hell he wants in his movies at this point. Big, also. He doesn't get to keep this woman that he seems to have fallen for because he's going to be a kid again. A League of Their Own. He's dead when the movie's over. So Hanks does not get true happy endings in his movies very often. Obviously, for Saving Private Ryan, where he dies, that's true too. And then Splash has to give up his brother and his normal life to be with Daryl Hannah's character. So that's a recurring theme for Hanks. As much as the peeing and as much as wanting to go home is, he's not going to get a true happy ending.
So they initially had Kevin Costner in mind, and he probably would have been great. But I think it would have been a really different film. And you know I'm a Kevin Costner fan. Apologist.
Me too.
We both are. And I think it would have been good. It just would have been different. He's just such natural swagger and confidence. But with Hanks, maybe one of his most underrated skills is his naturalism. He just makes it all look so real and so easy. If he's laughing at a joke or driving a car or doing math in zero gravity on a spaceship, I absolutely believe that he's doing math in zero gravity. That's what it would look like. So it becomes easy to forget that you're watching a movie. And in a movie like this, they work so hard to try and make you forget that you're watching a dramatic portrayal of something that really happened. What an incredible skill to bring to it.
You talk about alternate casting choices. So let's say it had been Costner, or if it was just still Hanks. But Kevin Bacon wasn't the first choice for the role. I think he's quite good, just like I think Paxton's quite good. But they talked about Brad Pitt or Val Kilmer before Bacon was even mentioned, I guess. And then in Paxton's role, it could have been John Cusack or Charlie Sheen. I could see Kilmer playing Swaggart for sure. But wouldn't it have been fun if it had been Hanks, Pitt, and Cusack in that cockpit? And again, no shade at all on Paxton and Bacon. Everyone loves Bill Paxton. Who doesn't? And Kevin Bacon, he's done 60-plus movies, and this is the first time we've ever covered one of his.
Really?
Can you believe that? We've never did Footloose.
Oh.
And a lot of other good films, but the first time we've ever actually covered him. Paxton, we've done lots of. Titanic and other Cameron movies.
Simple Plan.
And A Simple Plan, of course, too. But I would have loved to have seen, and had it been Costner, there you go, he could have had an entirely different cast and two people who were pretty close to being as big a name, if not bigger, in the case of Pitt versus Bacon in that cockpit. And Cusack, at one time at least, was as big a name as Paxton, and Costner then certainly was as big a name as Hanks. But Hanks would have been crushed because I know he really wanted this role, according to what Howard talked about in the commentary. And I've heard him talk about space stuff in other places, too. Look at one of the things he did after Saving Private Ryan, when he started doing Band of Brothers, which he produced. I think he directed and wrote some of those, but definitely produced that series. And then later on did The Pacific. But he also did From the Earth to the Moon, which is another documentary series. So after they've lifted off and all that goes fine, Engine 5 cuts out. And there's a question in the control room about, can they land on the moon with this engine being out? And the guy says, we'll be fine as long as they don't lose another one. And I think it's Lovell that says, we just had our glitch for this mission.
Yeah.
But when they have to dock with the LEM, there's all this tension about that. And in the control room, Chris Ellis, who was in Armageddon a couple years later in a similar kind of role, but he's Deke Slayton in this, very important part of NASA at that time. He says, come on, rookie, park that thing. They make it sound like if Swagger can't dock it, and I think somebody even says they don't have a mission. But Lovell says in the commentary, well, I would have gotten the seat then if he couldn't do it, or even Hayes would have. One of us would have been able to do it, and it wouldn't just be that he only gets one shot at it anyway. But Swaggart was very qualified. He wrote books on this stuff, too. All of these guys were, I don't know about geniuses, but experts on what they were doing. It wasn't like just Lovell knew everything, or had it been Neil Armstrong and his mission knew everything. The other guys knew stuff, and the mission control knew stuff, too. Most of these guys, like I said before, are fairly interchangeable because they're all really smart, and they all know as much as you possibly could. Yeah, Mattingly knows more about certain things, and Swaggart knows more about certain things, and Lovell does, and Armstrong, Pete Conrad. But it's not like one guy's Barry Bonds and the other guys are just mediocre ball players. They're all really good.
Yeah, you don't get to NASA by phoning it in. That's a bit of contrived drama. You've listed a few things that didn't really happen, that they didn't really fight in the ship. And that's just Apollo 13 trying to ramp up the drama so we don't get bored. But you mentioned, what did they say? Park this sucker?
Come on, rookie, park this thing.
Park this thing. I can't remember where I read that.
Park that thing, maybe.
The astronauts love that. That's a great illustration of how astronauts really talk. I read lots of praise for the script and just how much of the language that they get right. And one of them is that sometimes they say, park that thing.
I don't think anyone ever says in the movie what the LEM means. But I'm pretty sure I read this years ago that it means Lunar Excursion Module. But they never have a scene where somebody says to Marilyn or the media, this is what LEM means.
Because we don't need to know. Even if if we didn't put together what they're talking about when they're talking about Lem. So the little details aren't really what matters. The performances are conveying. There's a certain level of urgency. They don't ever get lost in the weeds when it comes to the technical stuff. Ron Howard has such a deft touch for bringing you in just enough to give it momentum and make it feel real, like it's a procedural, and then pull out when it gets a little bit too heady and you need a breather. The editing Oscar is so well deserved in this film, and it's little things like that that make it work.
Great example of drama as well. And Howard talks about this in the commentary too, that he loves this excitement over long division. Because they'd have to get into Lem, and they'd have to do some quick calculations to make sure that they've got everything prepared for that so the control module can be shut off.
While they're freezing cold.
Well, not yet. They weren't cold at that point.
Okay, but all the stress that they're under in that moment.
But then you get the thing where the guys go, yeah, agree. The camera dollies, I believe it is. Or anyway, you see the three guys all agree. It's just math, but they make that exciting too. And that is real. That's not some contrived scene.
Another Hidden Figures connection. That makes math so exciting.
Katherine Johnson would have likely been in that room, I would think.
Yeah, she would have been around somewhere.
She should have been.
I made a joke about that. Where's Katherine Johnson?
There are no women in that control room, and I don't know if there's anybody who's not white. I don't think there's any black people in there.
We do see black people eventually in the film because I commented on it, because it is almost alarming when you finally see somebody who's not white. But yeah, it's probably pretty period accurate. And in 1995, truly nobody paid much mind to this kind of thing anyway. Mm.
Well, we can't excuse even Ron Howard and Tom Hanks, as likable as they are. Everyone loves those two guys, because they probably in some ways have not been the most inclusive directors and actors in the world either, because they've been doing this a long time. And it's not like he can say, yeah, but the Hanks movies, the Howard movies, there's always Indians, as in from India, or Chinese people, or black people, lots of women. You can't always say that with their movies either. But that was just Hollywood back then. And then again, NASA probably predominantly was guys, dorky looking white guys, in fact, like his brother Clint, in his best role, I think, as Ecom. I love him. Cy Liebergott is his name. He's a lot of fun in Parenthood. He had no business being out there. No business. That's a great role, but this is his best role in his brother's films. And Clint was almost always in his brother's films.
Another nod to accuracy that they cast dorky looking guys and not good looking actors that they gave an embarrassing haircut and some thick glasses to. No, they cast some very normal-looking dudes. No, uggos or anything.
No.
But just not Hollywood hotties at all.
Yeah, Brett Cullen, who plays Capcom, is a pretty good-looking guy. And then Kevin Bacon himself is, I would say, a decent-looking, maybe a really good-looking guy. Well, you said you thought Ed Harris looked great in this movie.
Oh, Ed Harris was a piece back in the day. Okay. He truly was. I'm talking about everybody else. Okay, maybe not the big Hollywood stars. All of those actors that populated the control room.
But even the stars aren't really the Val Kilmers at that point, at least, who then was a heartthrob. He was in Heat this same year. Brad Pitt, obviously, is a heartthrob.
It was like the peak of Val Kilmer's career there, really. Mm-hmm. He kind of went downhill from the mid-90s.
Well, we talked about reality and verisimilitude, but then Lovell does have some fantasies, including walking on the moon, where he imagines he's stroking the ground with his gloved hand and raising up his visor, which is just so we can see his face, because I don't think you ever raise up your visor, because the sun would blind you, I believe, is where I've read. Even if you were facing away from it, it could be that much of a danger. That's why those things never come up.
Does the atmosphere protect us from the sun's brightness that much?
I think that's the case.
I guess so. What do you know?
But then he's the one that says to those guys about, I don't know what your intentions are, guys, but let's go home. And they still have days before they do get home because, like I said, 7 whole days in space. When they showed the graphic of where they were when the explosion happened, it seems like they were almost to the moon or pretty damn close to the moon.
2/3 of the way, something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because when they do the slingshot move, it looks like the way the movie portrays, there's not a lot of time for them to figure out, well, do we just turn them around immediately and then burn off a lot of fuel? That's a risk. Or do you use the moon's gravity and slingshot them, which is what they did. And that obviously worked. The movie portrays that Ken Mattingly being on Earth is a big part of what saved these guys because he figures out the power procedure. But it was many guys. I love Lauren Dean as John Aaron. He's an actor who's been in a ton of movies, but he's really good in this movie. He's always so clipped. You could tell he's the guy in the back who knows better than even all these very smart
which
people.
Which one is he again?
He's the guy that's working with Sinise to power up the
command
module through a lot of the movie. But he's in the background at one point, as is Todd Luiso. So the nanny from Jerry Maguire, comes up again, even has a line of dialogue. I never knew he was in this movie until I was looking to try. I was trying to find the obscure actors in movies, especially older ones. And this is older, but I'm talking 1950 or something like that. And you look for somebody who became a big star, who's got a small part in some Brando film or something. But in a movie that's 25 years old, you're bound to find a few people that weren't known at all then, who are either stars now or just well enough known. Todd Luiso is one of them. The movie is basically saying, though, that Mattingly is how they got saved because he figures out the power procedure. Somebody maybe would have, but it seems like it really came down to his intelligence. And it isn't long before they're about to land that he gets it to them as well. It's right towards the very end. Another thing I love, too, is the one guy explaining how the ship has to hit an exact point or they burn up or they bounce off when they're gone forever. And his analogy is you have to hit a space about the size of this piece of paper.
another thing that Hidden Figures is about. That's the whole thing in Hidden Figures that she has to figure out. That's the problem they're solving. Every choice that Howard makes in this film is celebrating banal heroism. There's no flashy moments where at the last minute our hero draws up and saves everybody just when they thought they were totally done for. They're just competent pilots and engineers and technicians who put their heads together and solve problems. It all feels very grounded and familiar, but also heartening and really impressive. They all really work together to solve each problem one at a time, and they treat it all like it has a solution instead of a disheartening disaster. You know, failure is not an option. And they each have their specialty, and they each come through in their own way, and they just put their noses down, and they are heroes. They save these lives. They save NASA. In the end, the effect is to leave us with this good feeling about humanity and our potential and ingenuity, and they do it all with slide rules. It's really great.
That's why it was 12th on the cheers list, because that means most inspiring. That's what that list is all about.
And it's not Schwarzenegger or Bruce Willis is coming in to save the day at the last minute. It's just truly hard work, and it's really what happened, which I think makes it even just that much more inspiring and heartening that this is what human ingenuity can realistically accomplish.
Including putting a square peg in a round hole, as Ed Harris says.
I always remembered that scene, mostly them ditching all the stuff onto the table, saying, This is what they have on board. You have to fix that with this. Such an interesting way to approach it. And then, of course, they pull it off.
And then when the astronauts are actually doing it on the ship, and they're all working together, and it wasn't long before they'd been fighting, and Hanks is saying, we're not going to go bouncing off the walls and come right back with the same problems. But soon after, I think it's exactly right after that scene. Oh, yeah, we're just looking at that too, Houston. The button indicating the CO2 levels, they hadn't noticed it because they weren't paying attention to that. They were fighting. But I like how the camera pulls out when the three of them are working together in this flightless environment. Maybe it was one of the comet shots. It must have been. And you got Lovell Hanks pulling off his sock in a cold spacecraft because it's part of the scrubber now.
That's right. Also, this is a film with no antagonist. I mean, I guess you could say the flawed ship, the problem is the antagonist, but I'm so grateful that they never tried to horn in some nosy journalist or naysaying NASA jerk to add extra cheap conflict where it wasn't necessary.
There are disputes, and most movies it would be worse. You got the one guy saying, who's also a flight commander, by the way. There are three of them. Ed Harris is just the main one. But the one guy saying to Henry, that's Sandra Berkeley's character, this could be the worst disaster NASA's ever faced. And then Harris says, I disagree, sir. I believe it's going to be our finest hour. But that guy has the same rank as Gene Kranz does.
I think every scene has some kind of conflict to give it drive, which is what writers have to do to keep a film interesting.
Yeah, and in most movies, that flight guy would have been an ass. The whole movie would have been a real problem, rather than that one scene where he's just telling what he thinks is true, which is, I don't think they're going to make it, versus the failure's not an option guy saying, we can't lose.
I will reference a bad movie about a great feat of engineering, and that is The Imitation Game. And there's a character played by Charles Dance, who's, I don't know, some commander in the army. I don't know. His whole job is to just antagonize him and yell at him for not doing it fast enough, not doing it the way he wants. And every scene ends with him saying, 24 hours. And it's so unrealistic. There's a movie that completely fails to put you there and make you believe that any of these things really happened.
I believed it more than you did.
Okay, I hate that movie so much. But all the things I'm praising Apollo 13 for, the verisimilitude, are things that I feel The Imitation Game dismally failed at.
You mentioned the media a second ago. The biggest problem with the media would be, and one of Kathleen Quinlan's red letter scenes is, get those cameras off my lawn. If they have a problem with that, they can talk to my husband. He'll be home in, whatever it is, 2 or 3 days.
It is extraordinarily rude. This woman might be widowed any minute. Let's get a shot of that.
But they're not battling with them. It's just that one scene she has that problem. And the other guy who's talking to Henry, where it's, when will we know? That black guy. I love the way he says that line. When will we know? And the reason why that's important, too, is because when he can say back to the media guy, blackout lasts 3 minutes, so they're not back in four, we'll know. And of course, for some reason,
moment.
No one's ever figured out why it took longer than it should have for them to come out of radio silence.
They never had an answer for that.
It was an extra minute. That was real. But anyway, he can say that to the media guy, so we can hear that as the audience.
They use the newscasts as a great little exposition tool. They would make these montages of them just describing what's happening so that they don't have to have these unnatural conversations with these NASA experts that know exactly what's happening, don't need to explain it to one another. Mm. Although they do fit a lot of exposition into this movie. It's just kind of like an elegant tool to use the press for that reason. also thrilled that they resisted the temptation to make Marilyn the antagonist the way they do in First Man, where they're like, well, he's a hero and everything went great, so how do we introduce conflict? Okay, make it seem like his wife is a harpy shrew that has no idea what happens when you marry a test pilot. Marilyn is upset and she's worried, but there's never just that scene that we've seen a million times where she hysterically yells at Krantz to bring her husband home. The drama is there and the movie trusts us to care about the stakes without cheap tricks like that.
She also knows what she's getting into, and he's been in space before. She's the one that says to Mary, just remember when you talk to the media, we're happy, proud, and thrilled. And Mary literally says that right seconds later to the media. Mary knows this now, but Marilyn already did know that I'm part of this team too. Hank says a line earlier about how the astronauts are just the front people on a team, and this is what the movie's all about, of course, of many people, hundreds of people that make the NASA program work at all. Well, we've talked a little bit about Ed Harris, but let's get more into him now because he's probably the best thing in this whole movie, and that's saying something because the whole cast is really good, and of course Hanks could have been nominated and Quinlan was. Kevin Spacey, I know he's anathema now, but when he was on Inside the Actors Studio, and they started talking about him winning the Oscar for The Usual Suspects. I'm not a big fan of that movie, but that's a really good performance. But he said he thought Ed Harris would win because of his body of work as much as anything else. I thought Harris should have won for the body of work thing. He was in The Right Stuff, by the way. I mentioned that earlier. And he plays an astronaut in that. He does go into space. He's John Glenn. But then in this movie alone, if this had been the only movie he'd ever done at that point, you'd say, that guy's so good. Okay, there's a moment in Lost Moon, that making of they do. The real Gene Kranz did an interview before they did the making of for Apollo 13. Because Ron Howard said to Ed Harris, I want to show you this moment that Kranz had. What happened was, and this might make me cry, because this guy is 65, 70, maybe even older at this point when he does the interview. And of course, this is 20 years before when the mission almost failed and they almost lost three guys in space. And it wasn't his fault, but he would have felt responsible. So he says, normally we don't celebrate till the crew gets on the command deck. And then cigars are lit, the world map comes up and all that stuff. But then when they saw the parachutes and the Odyssey was going to float down to safety. And again, in the real footage, you see those guys react as soon as they see the parachutes rather than hearing Lovell's voice. But when Harris doesn't celebrate and he sits down and I think he's tearing up. I'm pretty sure he tears up. But when Kranz talks about that 20 years later, he says the thing about those cigars and everything. And it was neat. There must have been a moment right after he said to the guy, give me a second. And this is one of those guys from the era. You don't cry ever. You don't cry if your wife died on camera anyway. And he's doing it about something where they lived. And then Harris said, okay, I got to play that moment, do I? All right, give it a shot. And he is awesome in that.
It's beautiful because he really cared that much. And those three astronauts never would have made it home without true commitment and caring for their safety. It says a lot about NASA. You hear stories about what the Russian space program was like, and they would have let those people die and kept it a secret, never let the media find out about it. There's tons of these stories. I mean, they're all rumors because we'll never know because they had covered up everything. Mm. But they didn't have that same attitude.
I remember saying this to somebody at work about 20 years ago. So I'd seen the movie two or three times at that point, probably. And I love the movie. And I love what really happened in reality and working together and all that. But I remember saying this to somebody then. Of course they should save these guys. Do the best they possibly can. But how many Americans died of neglect, living homelessly, whatever, during that same week? Hundreds, probably. In 1970, there aren't as many people, of course, to worry about. But you get my point, right?
Okay, you're being a total killjoy.
I know, but I said that to the guy at work, and he had the same response, which is, that's a good point. But that's what we do in this podcast, is think of things that are out of left field sometimes. And it's the right thing to do to save these guys. But how many people do we say, I don't care about you? We do it all the time, though, don't we? We care about...
First of all, their job. Second of all, these are their coworkers who they personally know.
I know.
But you're right, Americans care about their astronauts, but they don't care about a lot of other people, you're right.
So Gary Sinise was in Forrest Gump, which we, of course, covered many years ago. Great performance. Martin Landau won that year. Sam Jackson probably should have, but all the people I mentioned for that category those couple of years could easily have won. It probably should have been Harris and Jackson. Well, Harris in 95, Jackson in 94, but Spacey and Landau were good choices, too. But Sinise has been good for a long time. He was actually in three Hanks movies in the span of about 5 years, because it was Forrest Gump, and in that he says, the day you're a shrimp boat captain, that's the day I'm going to be an astronaut.
Well, he never did get to be an astronaut with Tom Hanks, did he?
Well, he's still an astronaut. He's not in space.
Are you an astronaut if you haven't been to space?
Well, he commanded the space shuttle, so he was an astronaut at some point.
Okay, all right then.
And he maybe already had been in space. I don't know. I don't think he had, actually. Sinise was also in The Green Mile with Hanks. Ed Harris we've covered in The Truman Show, History of Violence, and he's a voice in Gravity. We covered Gravity in our Now Playing project a long time ago when we saw that on the big screen. Talk about a big screen experience. Wow, Gravity.
And another great realistic space movie.
Rance and Gene Howard, who are Ron and Clint's mom and dad, are in this movie. Rance is the priest, I guess it is, at the end, who's comforting Marilyn. Doesn't have any dialogue, as I recall. But Jean Howard does play Jim Lovell's mother and has a lot of dialogue, including a scene with what's supposed to be Neil Armstrong. Neil and Buzz, in fact. Are you boys in the space program, too?
See, if she's that out of it, they could have just told her anything. Yeah, he walked on the moon. It was amazing. You watched it, remember?
Yep. Mark McClure, Back to the Future. He's Marty's brother, and of course he's Jimmy Olsen in the Superman films, 1978 and 1980 and so on. One of the many guys in NASA Mission Control. And then Roger Corman, who is one of Ron Howard's mentors, plays a congressman who actually has a line of dialogue too when he asks Lovell about having enough money or there are going to be cutbacks or something like that. Fitting that Roger Corman, who's known as the cheap director and producer of movies, would ask that question. And then Walter Cronkite's in the movie a lot, too, but it's all archive footage. He did re-record dialogue, and I was reading that before we watched the movie, but this time I was listening for it. I think I can hear the difference when it's an older man saying these lines as opposed to what is in the actual movie. I love his boyish enthusiasm when they show the footage when Neil Armstrong's about to step on the moon. He takes his glasses off, rubs his hands together. It's a really sweet moment, and that's real because that's the actual Walter Cronkite from 1969. We've talked about Ron Howard a lot already. He directed Parenthood and Splash, previous movies we've covered. Howard, of course, has directed a lot of films. He's got such a long list. He's only 66, though. He's just barely reached retirement age now, and he's directed so many movies, including Solo, only a couple years ago, I guess it was, which I've only ever seen once. Not really his movie. We haven't talked at all about the writers, Bill Broyles and Al Reinert. Broyles later wrote Castaway for Hanks, so obviously Hanks knew him from this film. Reinert's only got four scripts in his resume. This was his first, but John Sayles, the guy from Lone Star and Eight Men Out, as he often was in the 90s, was a ghostwriter on this movie. Tarantino was doing a lot of that back at this time, too, because the same year as this, Crimson Tide, Tarantino wrote some of the dialogue for that movie.
There's probably lots of movies that Tarantino has ghostwritten for that we'll never know about. I know Tina Fey has done interviews that she's uncredited on a lot more scripts than anybody realizes.
There's never just one writer on a screenplay, even if it only has one person that's credited. Maybe not never ever, but very rarely. And it is based on the Lost Moon book, the 1994 book by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger. And the producer, of course, is always Brian Grazer, who almost always works with Howard, except for Solo. He didn't produce that because it wasn't anything to do with him. And Howard was a director for hire. Movies 2, 3, 9, 1, we watched a doggone-looking Blu-ray print. I've owned that movie for probably one of my first Blu-rays, I guess. Cinematographer Dean Cundey, he's been covered a lot on this channel. The Thing, Back to the Future, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Jurassic Park. A ton of movies with John Carpenter. Worked with him a ton back in the day. And one thing I don't think I ever noticed before until this viewing was the push-pull shot. The most famous example is probably Vertigo, right? When Jimmy Stewart climbs the stairs, has the vertigo, and you can see that woo-looking trombone shot. People call it that sometimes, too. It's in Jaws when Chief Brody sees the kid get killed by the shark. It's in Goodfellas when Jimmy's meeting with Henry at one point when they're at a diner. And it's in this movie when Gene hears that they're venting O2. Because when he realizes they're losing oxygen, oh no. A, are they going to die? And B, they're not landing on the moon.
It's very subtle because I didn't notice it.
When Cy tells them they have to shut off one of the fuel cells, you can't land on the moon with one healthy fuel cell. He knows then when Cy's telling them that he's right, the mission's over. Are they even going to live at all? The editors Mike Hill and Dan Hanley always work with Ron Howard, maybe not Solo, but everything else I think he's ever done. They've been the editors for that, including Splash and Parenthood. And the composer James Horner, I know he didn't like the music, but he's been on this channel a lot. Field of Dreams, which Chris and I covered last year. Glory and Titanic won the Oscar, or maybe it was even two Oscars. Didn't he co-write My Heart Will Go On with Celine? Anyway, bit of a legend, a lot of great scores, but you didn't like this one. Anyway, what did you think of the look, the cutting, and we know you didn't like the music because I'm already telling everyone that you didn't.
The technicals are so immaculate, the cinematography and editing. I just can't say enough great things about it. The score, just throw it in the trash. Start over, better yet, I don't know. Ditch most of it and just stick to a few key moments.
As far as the editing goes, it's a pretty long movie. It's well over 2 hours long, and yet it does not feel like a long movie.
It moves. I was surprised how quick it went by.
As for what happens next, Apollo 14.
Apollo 14, the mission that Lovell should have been commanding, and he would have walked on the moon.
That really was the next mission, and the third one that did land on the moon. So that is what happens next.
He would have been hitting golf balls. And... yeah,
that really was what happened. Okay, last thoughts on our last movie of June, because we'll be off next week, Apollo 13.
This is a real pleasure. It's not a movie that I've really thought about or considered much. I always knew that you loved it, but I should have given this another chance many times over the years. I really, really enjoyed it.
I also finally realized where Annie Lennox has a singing credit on this, because I think it's in the beginning credits. I noticed that. And we just had the movie playing the credits while we were talking about it afterwards and cleaning up down here. And you could hear her going, ooh. I can't do anything close to Annie Lennox, but.
No, I thought she was here. In the
ethereal voice. I cannot do ethereal at all. Well, unlike the real life story, this movie is a successful success. I've seen it so many times and it never fails to thrill me and move me. So I'm saying it should be on the throws list, and it definitely belongs on the cheers list. The actors are good across the board, and Ron Howard's direction has never been better. Ed Harris is outstanding. You think he's pretty hot, too.
Back in his prime, which lasted a long time. Chef's kiss.
You could score this movie. And I rank it second after Toy Story in what was a great year at the movies. I could look at my top 10 in 1995 and reorder it, probably, and still have number 1, 2, and 3 be awesome, even if it isn't Toy Story, Apollo 13, and I forget what third was. But that's a great year at the films, and we're going to do some more of those before this year is over. Okay, outstanding film, and that's the end of Apollo 13. We're going dark next week because it is a holiday week. Canada Day is a couple of days after. We would post, and we could use a little R&R. So when the Ellis's Analysis returns on July 6th, we're going to talk about Love After Death as we look back at a smash hit from 30 years ago, Ghost. The coming attractions, and it is trivia, not an opinion this time. Ghost was 19th on the Top 100 Passions list. There are 12 movies ahead of it that also made the 1998 and or 2007 AFI Top 100. So the main lists, the greatest movies of all time lists. And we're talking about Casablanca, Gone with the Wind, My Fair Lady, for example. And how many of those 12 did one of the two people of the main couple die, just as Patrick Swayze does in Ghost?
All right, so for the answer to that question, tune in for our next podcast about Ghost. In the meantime, check out our website, top100project.com. And don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. And in exchange for all of this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. It helps people find us. We're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
Gentle Bev, it's been a privilege podcasting with you.
She sure was a good podcast host. And cut.